5 in Savoy, online at wardenmartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge, for today and for the next couple of weeks. Our producers, by the way, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the control. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll do something we do once a month on the show, talk about personal finance. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He has a wide-ranging background in a lot of areas dealing with money management and personal finance and investing and so forth. And he's here to take your questions. That's what the show is all about. We'll start with some topics that are relevant, particularly at this point in time. And David will talk for a bit, and then we'll open up the phone lines and invite you to ask your own questions about personal finance. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. And I'll repeat those numbers during the show. And good morning, David Sinnoh.
And good morning, Jack. As always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. While 9/11 is a date that Americans will always remember, I think that Gulf Coast residents of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama will certainly not forget August 29, 2005, when Hurricane Katrina made landfall. Now, we could spend hours in terms of the human tragedies wrought by this unparalleled storm. They are indelibly written, both into our minds and, of course, into our hearts. And years from now, Americans and our political leaders will be debating and studying the government and the private sector response, their recovery efforts toward literally millions of people impacted by this storm. However, that's really not my focus in these opening remarks. Rather, I'd like to spend just a few minutes with you discussing the economic impacts and suggest that you take a fresh look at your own risk management portfolio and, more specifically, your own insurance coverages. First, some very preliminary economic statistics. Estimated property damage from Hurricane Katrina, these are preliminary estimates, likely to go higher, in excess of $100 billion. Potential jobs lost, at least in the short run, more than 400,000 jobs. First-time filers, for example, for unemployment compensation increased 68,000 just last week. The biggest jump in a decade. Ultimately, more than 400,000 jobs, as I pointed out, could be lost. More than 500,000 structures damaged or destroyed. In the short run, the annual growth of our economy could be slowed by as much as 20%. Obviously, everything that is petroleum-based has become or will become just a heck of a lot more expensive. Gasoline, of course, well over $3 in some areas of the country, although I did notice in Urbana-Champaign this morning a drop to about $2.75 a gallon. Consumer and retail inflation has surged dramatically, not over the past 2 months, but also over the past 4 weeks, up some 0.5% every 4 weeks. And while property damage may well exceed $100 billion, most insurance consulting firms are estimating that insured losses from private insurance companies will be far less, typically and most likely in the range of $35 to $50 billion. And a substantial portion of that sum will not be paid to individuals, will not be paid to homeowners, but will be paid to businesses for business interruption insurance. And that is due to the fact that the insurance companies that provide storm coverage for our home, for our contents, specifically exclude damage due to water surge and flooding. Flood insurance is underwritten by the federal government, or essentially the American taxpayer. And for those who have had experience with flood insurance, they will find out, number one, it is extraordinarily expensive. And number two, when it comes to replacing contents, contents are replaced at a depreciated or actual cash value and not at replacement cost. So if my home floods and I lose a $1,000 television set. It costs $1,000 to replace that television set, and I've had it 2 years. Flood insurance might tell me, well, the depreciated value or the actual cash value is far less than that $1,000. Maybe it's $200 or $300, assuming that you can even prove that you actually owned that television set. Now, by way of comparison, the insurance industry has ranked their 25 largest losses of all time, restated into 2005 dollars, or in other words, adjusted for inflation. And I'd like to share some of that data with you. On that basis, the largest insured loss of all time, interestingly enough, was the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire, with an inflation-adjusted loss of approximately $28 billion. Now, we're pretty clear that Katrina is going to top that. But I find it interesting, inflation-adjusted, 1906, the San Francisco earthquake and fire, which ravaged and basically destroyed that city. 9/11 was less, $23.7 billion paid out by the insurance industry. And Hurricane Andrew, back in 1992, $23.1 billion. Now, ultimately, no one has a really good handle on the amount of money that insurance companies are going to be required to pay for Katrina's devastation. For example, there will be life insurance claims. A number of people died, unfortunately. Tragically, some of those folks had life insurance, leaving funds to beneficiaries. There are likely to be massive health insurance claims for literally months, if not for years to come. Health insurers are anticipating a geometric increase in mental health-related claims. Interestingly enough, according to the Best Week Insurance Journal, which is sort of a Bible for insurance information, this is from their journal of September 12th. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Louisiana, for example, is making special provisions for its 330,000 members in 14 different parishes. The plan is allowing its customers to refill drug prescriptions as necessary and assisting those who have lost medications, don't remember dosage instructions, or no longer can receive shipments via the plan's mail order service. Imagine that. In addition, prior authorization requirements have been lifted for covered members, and a grace period for paying premiums is given to group businesses and individual customers. A number of other health insurers have also set up similar provisions in Louisiana for its affected members, including Aetna, Cigna, Coventry, Humana, Pacific Care, WellPoint, and a host of others. How are we even going to get medical care? In the New Orleans area alone, the Louisiana Department of Insurance estimates that there are more than 100,000 people currently under medical evaluation. In fact, the department is seeking clear direction from its various medical insurance companies doing business in their state on how in the world they are going to provide coverage to their members when their members have been evacuated and their typical health care providers are not even in business. This is an enormous problem, an enormous financial problem yet to unfold. Additionally, there are likely to be billions of dollars of claims in business interruption insurance. Businesses often insure against loss of profits due to a disaster, such as fire, storm, or even flood. Billions of dollars of claims are anticipated from the tourist industry, the energy and transportation industries, and of course the real estate industry, where rental property is prime, where tenants have been evacuated, where buildings have been destroyed, and lost income or business interruption is the story of the day. In the final analysis, when the untold life insurance claims, property claims, health insurance claims, and business interruption claims are totaled up, the real question is the life insurance industry able to financially pay? That's sort of a threshold question. And I think what we will find is that the answer, interestingly enough, is a resounding yes. According to UBS Investment Research, a very prominent insurance research bureau, the insurance industry has on hand, at the end of calendar year 2004, more than $400 billion of divisible surplus. That surplus is set aside. It's generating income. It's invested in stocks, bonds, and security. It's specifically set aside for potential claims. So if these claims ultimately inure to $50 billion, $75 billion, $100, even $150 billion, yes, there's money there. Now, what insurance lessons can we learn from this tragedy? How can we bring this down to our level specifically and see what we should be doing? First, it seems to me that it would be very prudent to pull out all of your policies and call your agent and schedule a review of your coverages and ask the following questions. Do you live in a floodplain? And if so, have you purchased flood insurance? Are the contents of your home insured for replacement cost, or are they insured for depreciated or actual cash value cost? If you are a condominium owner, is the association adequately insured for replacement cost of the buildings and adequately covered for liability? Because if you live in a condominium development, and the Condominium Development Association carries liability insurance, and someone or some group of people are dramatically injured, and there is not enough liability insurance, interestingly enough, these injured parties can go back and look to the individual condominium owners for redress. Do you have a video, not pictures, of everything in your house, but do you have a shot video of all contents of your home and your garage so you can easily prove your loss? It's not enough to say that you have sustained a loss. Sometimes you've got to prove your loss. And it seems to me a picture is worth a thousand words and a video is even better. What is the policy or procedure your medical insurance program provides in the event you suddenly are displaced from your current medical providers, from your hospitals, from your doctors? What happens with your premiums? How do you access medical care? What's covered? What's not? These are questions that people are now starting to ask as a result of Hurricane Katrina. And they are all legitimate questions, and you need to have answers. So my advice number one is schedule a meeting with your agent. Probably not this week, probably not next week, but put it on your goals and objectives to accomplish prior to the end of the year. And otherwise, all of us will stay tuned to this one as recovery efforts really are now really beginning to unfold. All right. As promised each month, we are following up on the David Sinnoh Couch Potato Equity Portfolio. That's what I like to call it because some of my vices are, one, sitting on the couch, two, I really do love potato chips, much to the consternation of my lovely wife, Carol, and three, occasionally I like to watch football and other sports on television. So there I am, a typical couch potato feeding my face and not worrying, interestingly enough, about my portfolio. Now, you'll recall that it consists of the following Vanguard mutual funds. And again, I just happen to choose Vanguard because they are a low-cost provider, but these funds can be basically duplicated at other mutual fund companies. 10% of my money in the S&P 500, 15% of my money in the U.S. Value Mutual Fund, 10% of my money in a small cap index, call it the Russell 2000, 15% of my money in small cap value, 10% of my money in the mid caps, that's called the S&P 400, 10% of my money in REIT, REIT indexes, that's an index of all of those companies that own and manage real estate and are traded on the exchanges, 20% international index, and 10% in the emerging markets, the very, very small markets around the world. And interestingly enough, those markets include countries like Israel, India, Chile, Brazil, Argentina, even South Africa, etc. All right, how's it done through yesterday? Year to date, how has this portfolio performed? And interestingly enough, including dividends, this portfolio through yesterday is up almost 7.9% for the year. I think that's pretty decent when compared to our benchmark S&P 500, if that's what we're going to use as our proxy or our benchmark. And the S&P 500 inclusive of dividends is up about 2.5% for the year. So right now, we're running about 5.5% positive delta to the S&P 500. And at least at the moment, I guess that makes me happy, so I can probably sit another day or another weekend, maybe having a potato chip on the couch, although my wife Carol already is insisting that today, tomorrow, and Sunday, I have to do my 2.6-mile walk before I can do any fishing. So she's already informed me of that. Well, there you have it, Jack. I'd be delighted to tackle questions on these issues that I've raised, some of these insurance issues, or other wealth management issues on the minds of our listeners.
Okay. Well, there's a lot there to talk about. And if you have questions, you can certainly join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. And again, we're speaking with David Sinnoh this morning, taking your questions on personal finance. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. So your questions are more than welcome. Just a quick follow-up on the portfolio, 7-point-something percent.
9%,
yeah,
yes.
Right. And this is, you would consider this, I would imagine, you know, having spoken with you a number of times, this is not a high risk portfolio. This is a relatively conservative.
Well, it's a well-diversified portfolio.
Yes.
Let me put it that way. It's extremely well-diversified across a number of asset classes. And when we talk about volatility of a portfolio, what we're really measuring is how volatile year to year our portfolio is as compared to an expected return on a portfolio. And for mathematical wizards and econometric wizards, we do that by measuring something called standard deviation, one standard deviation really, which means about 68% of the time, what is the range of returns that we would expect in this portfolio? Mm-hmm. And very frankly, looking at this particular portfolio, I think our expected return, looking at historical data, is in the 9 to 10% area mm-hmm. for this kind of return. And one standard deviation is about 11%. So we could expect a range of returns from 10 being our expected, but as high maybe as 21% and as low being a negative 1 or negative 2, about 68% of the time. Mm-hmm. And we are going to have some negative years because if we look at the U.S. stock market, mm-hmm. the bottom line is that about one out of every 4 years is negative. And our job as investors is to lose as little as possible in those inevitable periods of time where the stock market goes down. Everybody makes money when the stock market goes up. The key to a investment history and an investment experience that you will enjoy is to lose as little as possible in those inevitable down years. You do that by being intelligently diversified.
Okay. Well, we have several callers waiting. Let's go on and talk with someone from Urbana first on line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I just heard you talk about the returns of the international investment of 7-point-something percent relative to the S&P, and I found that differential to be really fairly low given the risk premium that's involved in investing overseas, especially in developing markets with quite immature markets without the degree of regulation that you have in the United States and elsewhere in industrialized states. I was wondering if you might rather suggest an international investment portfolio that would include some companies, Israeli companies, indeed there are Chinese companies and so forth, that are listed as ADRs on the New York Stock Exchange, as something that at least would take into account the fact that a lot of markets overseas are not regulated the way they are in the United States, and there's an enormous risk problem in doing that.
Well, actually, you raise an interesting point, but let me be clear. In my particular portfolio, 20 cents of my dollar is in something called the Total International Index, which are really some of the major companies all around the world. And in fact, that index through yesterday was up 8.57% for the year. And 10% of my funds are in the emerging market index among all of these countries. True, some of that is less regulated, although it's becoming more regulated. That particular index is up 18.66% for the year. So 10% of my money is in that index. Now, admittedly, those two indexes, when you invest internationally or anywhere in the world, you're going to introduce volatility into your portfolio. However, mathematically, that is not a bad thing. That, interestingly enough, when you mathematically model, what you will find out is that even though certain asset classes have higher risk and maybe even higher return, more volatility, when you mix those appropriately with other asset classes, you actually reduce the overall volatility of the portfolio. So year to year, I'm not as concerned. And for anyone who follows me, I'm what's called a legacy investor. I'm looking at long-range expected rates of return over 25 and 30-year periods. And it is true for someone who wants to essentially focus in on one asset class, the emerging markets, or investing in foreign stocks. If you are a stock picker, by all means, you could look at ADRs, American Depository Receipts, and try to utilize those. But frankly, I'm just not a stock picker. Some people are great stock pickers. I'm an indexer, and I just don't want to, frankly, spend the time and spend the amount of effort that is necessary to really analyze those particular individual stocks. So I would rather own the entire asset class. I can tell what the volatility of that asset class is. I can chart its standard deviation. So I can mix it with the portfolio and mathematically determine the volatility of my overall portfolio. But certainly your points are well taken.
You are aware that indexes often comprise dominant companies, including the U.S., NASDAQ, or anything else would consist of companies with very high market capitalization, and you're really focusing on maybe a few companies, and that's really masking the entire index.
That's why only 10% of my money, for example, is in the S&P 500, because there is so much more to the market than the S&P 500. We've got the Russell 2000, where I have 15% of my money, which are much, much smaller capitalized companies. We're talking about companies that are in the low billions as opposed to companies that are $50 to $100, $200 billion. So again, that's why we have this diversification with my dollar in the portfolio. And again, you sound well studied in these matters, and your points are certainly positive and well taken.
Hope the caller will forgive me, but our lines are full and I want to include as many people as possible. We'll go next to a listener in the Chicago area on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Hi there.
Hi. I have two questions. One is, first of all, unfortunately, the phone rang just when you were starting to list your portfolio. If you could just very quickly just mention again which are you're in. And I just heard that they were mostly in Vanguard. And then secondly, how much are you concerned about the just incredibly increasing deficit in terms of how you're seeing investment, or are you thinking that's going to be a more long-term effect? It's a little bit confusing because it seems like every day we see this deficit increase massively, and somehow, you know, how does that affect us on a day-to-day basis right now?
Okay, let me quickly run through the portfolio one more time.
Okay.
And this is on a percentage basis. These are Vanguard funds. But again, let me caution the listeners that you could utilize other asset class funds from other providers.
Sure.
10 cents on the dollar, or 10%, is in the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
15 cents on the dollar, are in large value. It's a large value asset class. 10% are in the Russell 2000, smaller companies. 15% are in an asset class called small company value, which is taking the smaller companies inside the Russell 2000 and buying those that are really selling on the cheap, so to speak.
Yeah.
The mid-caps, which is known as the S&P 400, an asset class that has been on fire for quite some time, 10 cents on the dollar. Uh-huh. That's called the mid-caps. The REIT index, the real estate investment trusts, 10 cents on the dollar. That's had a compounded rate of return of almost 20% for the last 5 years. Don't pour a lot of money in it today because things do regress to their mean.
Right.
So it's just part of the overall portfolio. 20% in the Vanguard Total International Index, which really covers Europe, Australia, the Far East. And finally, 10 cents on the dollar in something called the emerging markets around the world.
Okay.
Now, that was the first question. The second question we asked is just how concerned am I about deficits that may be just getting worse?
Yes.
And I think we have to be honest with ourselves. Are deficits getting worse? I think so. I think after hearing President Bush last night and making the pledge of reconstruction funds, our continued spending all over the world and issues at home, yes, we're spending a lot more than we're taking in. Congress has to recognize that. This administration has to recognize that. How is that going to affect the overall stock market? In the short run, I don't have a clue. That's what I'm going to tell you. And frankly, I don't care. Isn't that an interesting response? Because you see, I go back and look at the history of the stock market from the 20s through today. And what I see are the 1929 stock market crash. I see World War II. I see the Vietnam War. I see the rise and the fall of communism and the Berlin Wall. I see the 83 stock market debacles. I see the 87 market crash. I see the 2000 internet bubble. And you know, after seeing all of that, interest rates in the, it was the late 70s, the Carter years, interest rates, 15, 16, 18, 20% to borrow money, double-digit inflation, stagflation, everything possible thrown at our economy, the bottom line is that you cannot find a consecutive 25-year period of time in U.S. history where you wouldn't have been better off owning common stocks than almost any other investment. So as long as you maintain a legacy approach, as long as you maintain an approach where I am going to make a commitment to stocks for a minimum of 25 consecutive years, then I'm going to be all right if we believe in the lessons of history. And I happen to believe that. So I am a perennial optimist to begin with. It's more fun to be an optimist than a pessimist. And again, if you are going to be committed to the stock market, then my belief is you have to make a very long-term commitment. Individual stock selection and market timing, which you hear about all of the time on the television stations, that's all they talk about. What stock you should be in today, what stock you should sell tomorrow. And, oh, my goodness, the market's going up today or the market's going down. You better get in or better get out. Almost all of the really good academic studies that have been performed, many of them by scholars at the University of Illinois, overwhelmingly suggest that stock selection and market timing contribute less than 10% of the overall return that you will earn in a stock market portfolio. So I dismiss that. I dismiss short-term events. I'm looking for long-term and the long-term history and the momentum of the market.
Well, thank you. That's very interesting and comforting. I am also only in, at this point, mostly index funds, so I was very interested in your reaction.
Well, good for you, and stay the course.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We're well past our midpoint here with David Sinnoh, professor of finance at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, taking your questions on personal finance. We have a couple of callers waiting and time for others if you'd like to join us with your questions. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else you can hear us around the continental U.S. If you're listening online, you can call us at 800-222-9455. Next up, an Urbana listener on line number three. Good morning.
Yes, I had a question. I have $3,500, which is not much at all, but to invest for a 9-year-old potentially going to college. Where would you put that?
Well, $3,500 is a lot of money, and it's a great idea to be investing for a 9-year-old for college. Have you considered any of the college savings plans that are available through the various states or through brokerage firms or mutual fund companies?
I have. The only thing is I don't know where we'll be. I thought about College, Illinois, but we may have to move to take care of older parents, et cetera. Before that, you know, she would end up going, and I can't be sure where she'll go.
Well, these are called 529 plans, and there are really two different types of Section 529 plans. The type that you were just alluding to is something called a prepaid tuition plan. And, of course, if you invested in a prepaid tuition plan in Illinois, that money is still available to be utilized anywhere in the country. So some people misunderstand that. The second type of 529 plan is where you take money and you invest the money in a menu of choices with a provider, if you will, and then that money grows tax-free so long as it is spent for higher education expenses, tuition, fees, books, housing, etc. And again, I would think that probably at 9 years old, since you're really not going to be accessing this money until at least maybe 18, 19, 20, that I would probably go ahead and open a 529 plan with this money. Whether you do it through a state program in Illinois or whether you do it, for example, with a mutual fund company, they all offer 529 plans, that this would then provide an appropriate vehicle to continue to add money to toward a college education. So you really have a focused investment strategy to at least help with some of the extraordinary expenses that that 9-year-old is going to be facing in about 9 or 10 years. And at that particular age, I would be prone with my $3,500 to probably buy maybe one or two indexes. Buy a broadly based index, for example, a total market index, as well as a small company index. So I would hedge my bets between buying big companies and buying small companies. And then for birthday presents or people who want to make presents, maybe grandparents, whatever, this would be an ideal vehicle to continue to save for college education. So I'd look really into a 529 plan, especially because of the benefits of tax freedom, so to speak, and it's just a good thing to do. So I think you're on the right track here.
Okay. I did know, though, that the prepaid tuition plans, you say you can use them anywhere, but there kind of is a catch because you don't get the same return. It's not near as good a return if you go to take that and go to another state.
Well, not exactly. Not exactly. Here's the way it works. Here's the way it works. Let's say that you are going to buy two semesters of prepaid tuition, and you're planning to send your child to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and then you move out of state. Here's what the state of Illinois does. They look at the average tuition at all of the member institutions in the state of Illinois, Northern, Southern, Eastern, Western, University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And then they take an average of that tuition, and that's the amount of money that would be available for you to spend whether your child went to Northwestern or Cal Berkeley or anywhere else in the country. So admittedly, it may be a little less because the tuition at the University of Illinois is a higher tuition than at Eastern, Western, Southern, and Northern, and you would be getting an average of those tuitions. But it's not as much of a reduction as you may think.
I see.
Okay, was that
Yes.
Explained to you so you understood it.
Yes, it was. And the scope of things covered by that 529 expenses, such as books and housing and that, that's pretty wide scope, isn't it?
Very wide scope. You just have to keep your kids out of the restaurants, I think, and the bars.
Yes.
That
okay.
isn't covered.
Thanks so much.
Okay, a pleasure talking with you.
You too.
Thanks for the call. We have a couple callers waiting. We'll go next to a Champagne listener on line number one. Good morning.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
My question goes more towards, I guess in reference to the portfolio that you laid out for your couch potato, if you were investing a lump sum towards retirement, and is using it in that portfolio better than in, say, an annuity where the taxes on, say, the dividend growth would be deferred, or is it still better than trying to, go the annuity route?
Well, let me say this. I think for a number of people, you need to be doing both. The portfolio that I set before you is a portfolio that is intelligent for the amount of money you feel comfortable with devoting to the stock market, to equities. And, of course, an annuity, when you buy an annuity, that annuity is providing you with a regular stream of income, something you know that you can rely on. And, indeed, you can even purchase an annuity today which can be adjusted for inflation. Now, you raise really a different issue, and I want to talk about that. And that's the tax angle of it, and a lot of annuities are sold. These are typically single premium deferred annuities where you take a lump sum of money, you hand it to the insurance company, they invest it at a fixed rate of interest, and they say, look, the advantage of doing that is that all of the earnings that we are paying you before you pull them out are tax deferred. And it's only when you pull them out that you're going to get taxed on them. That's one of the arguments for purchasing an annuity in the accumulation phase. There are lots and lots of studies that have been done. And what we have found is that the truth of the matter is that by indexing and going into low turnover indexes that generate very little capital gains, that you are actually tax-wise better off when you pull the money out of low-cost indexes, even though you're using after-tax money to do this, than waiting to pay the taxes down the road when you pull out your money out of annuities. And Scott Burns writes a great deal about this area, and he talks about Social Security creep, which simply means that by investing a lot of money in annuities and then pulling that money out at retirement, a lot of that money is going to be taxable to you unless you annuitize it. But most people don't. What they do is they just pull money out in increments, and the first money coming out of those programs is interest. That's reported as ordinary income, and one of the things that that can do is it can increase the impact of the taxes that you pay on Social Security benefits, because a percentage of people's Social Security benefits are not even subject to tax when they take them out. And that's based upon a complex numerical formula as to how much money you actually make. And when you add interest income back into that formula, a lot of people find out that more of their Social Security benefits are subject to being taxed than otherwise. So that's another reason to tread carefully on these annuities. And I talked about last month, I talked about the idea of taking a lump sum and immediately handing it to an insurance company and receiving a monthly annuity benefit for the rest of your life. And only 1% of annuities that are offered and sold in the United States are of that type. And to me, that's probably the most practical, especially if interest rates continue to trend up. There are going to be some enormous opportunities in that particular area. So I'm not sure if I've really answered your question or not, but from a tax standpoint, I'm not sold. I'm simply not sold on the benefit of single premium deferred annuities. And from an equity standpoint, I want to be very clear that my couch potato portfolio is a portfolio with only a portion of your money. Obviously, you need to have emergency funds. You need to have the basics. You need to have cash in reserve, maybe a decent insurance program, and perhaps even annuities, a pension plan, a profit-sharing plan, something else as well.
So now I understand the you know, sort of immediate income stream annuity is different, but what I was thinking in terms of like the Vanguard has variable annuities.
Yes.
That sort of thing. That,
yes.
Is that different or the same from what you were talking about?
No, that's a variable annuity, and I am more sold on owning the indexes, the underlying indexes. And interestingly enough, even at Vanguard, if you look at the menu of choices within their variable annuities, they don't offer you all of the asset classes. They only offer you some of the asset classes. So I have a little bit of difficulty with the Vanguard variable annuities because I can't diversify as well as I would like to in that variable annuity product. But clearly one thing Vanguard has done in the variable annuity product is they have cut out the expenses compared to the typical insurance company. So if you were going to buy a variable annuity, in my opinion, it's a better deal. But when you compare it to taking that money and just simply investing in a asset class indexed portfolio, I'd prefer the latter.
Okay. And with the what do you suggest in terms of if, you know, for the, I guess, fixed income in terms of this state of affairs, more short-term, intermediate, long-term bonds?
Frankly, I love the banks competing at the CD rate right now. That's what I really like. If you start shopping CDs, either locally or on the internet, you're going to find CDs that are 1 year or less over 4%. I think that's very, very tough to beat. FDIC insured, and I think that's a decent place to put money.
Okay, hope the caller will forgive me again. We have two callers waiting in less than 10 minutes. I want to include both and more if we have time. We'll go next to a listener waiting patiently on a cell phone, line number 4. Good morning. Hello? Is the caller there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, good morning. My call is this. I'm an optimistic person. I have been fully invested in the stock market, and I've been doing very, very well. You know, I listen to you, and I, you know, you go back in history and you see different crisis periods, and you say, you know, we've survived and we've come out ahead. What really concerns me, you know, is what recently happened. We had, you know, our anniversary of 9/11. We've had the Katrina response by local and federal government. We've had an Al Qaeda person on the network singling out Los Angeles and Melbourne, Australia. I'm becoming very uneasy, and I'm losing confidence, or maybe a better term would be a sense of security with the system. So I get, my question is, assuming that out of your portfolio, which elements of that portfolio would be best suited to withstand a major terrorist attack in the United States? Which one of those elements of the portfolio, feeling this way, should I maybe lean towards?
That's an extraordinary question. I don't have a good answer to it. I think I would really need to think about it, but it's, again, an extraordinarily intelligent question, and I'm not certain that it would matter. I'm not certain that it would matter which part of the portfolio that you were in. I just simply need to spend some time thinking about it, but I will promise you this. I'll take a look at that question, and I'll ask some other scholarly folks about that question over at the University of Illinois during the next month, and I will report back in my opening remarks as to which asset classes are better suited, if any, to withstand what you're referring to and what a lot of people are worried about are catastrophic shocks, the confluence, if you will, of catastrophic shocks not only to the U.S. economy, to the world economy. So we're talking about the 9/11s. We're talking about natural disasters. We're talking about Al-Qaeda. We're talking about other kinds of confluence of events. And what you're really asking is, can the system, if it is simultaneously impacted from a number of different areas, how resilient is that system? That's the real question that you're asking. And not only are you asking this question, but some of the most prominent people in the country are asking this question, including Alan Greenspan and probably the greatest stock market investor of all time, Warren Buffett. He has been asking this question, and his team of analysts are analyzing this question. So you are in great company, if you will, by asking this question. And I'm going to try for you, because I'm even intellectually interested in what you are saying, trying to see, is there an asset class other than maybe treasuries, but that's fixed income? Is there an asset class that would not be subject to this volatility? And even treasuries are going to be subject to interest rate risk and essentially purchasing power risk. That if we buy treasuries that are other than very short-term treasuries and we suddenly have massive inflation, something else in this economy, obviously even that type of investment is going to have substantial purchasing power risk. So you raise a great question. And you've given me some homework to report on next time.
Okay. Well, we have two calls waiting. We'll try to get them both in. Next up, someone in Kankakee on line number two. Good morning.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of questions related primarily to the total stock market index. I understand, and I'm referring to the Vanguard.
Sure.
I understand that Morningstar has reduced their rating on that fund, and I also understand that Scott Burns is still recommending it. I just have like $25,000. I'd like to be diversified. I'm concerned about investing in several funds, as you suggest with your investment plan. So, with $25,000, would you think that the total stock market index is still a good recommendation, and perhaps there's a second or third fund we should look at?
Well, let me react to you. If you have all of your equity money in the total stock market index and believe that you are diversified, you are not. Mm-hmm. The total stock market index, approximately 85% of it, as I recall, is S&P 500. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So what you really have is an S&P 500 fund with a little smattering of other stocks. And even though you own thousands and thousands of companies, the truth of the matter is that you own the S&P 500. So that's the asset class that you have. And again, in my particular portfolio, I only have 10% of my money in the S&P 500. So while people think they are well diversified, they really aren't in the total market index. It's not to say it's not a great index. It's not to say it isn't a great way to own companies. It's simply to recognize that what you own are basically very big companies. And to give it another point of view, the top 10 companies in the S&P 500 comprise more than 20% of its value. So it's fair to say that 20 cents of every dollar that you have invested in the total market index are basically in 10 companies, like General Electric, like Microsoft, like Exxon. So you really aren't diversified. Now, in terms of diversifying, you really lack small company exposure, like the Russell 2000, which behaves differently than the S&P 500, and then the value components of both, large value and small value. So if it were me, first I would check my tax impact if I were to sell my shares. What kind of tax impact would I be looking at? And then I would be diversifying that position, as long as that wasn't too painful, into four asset classes, maybe 25% S&P, 25% Russell 2000, 25% small company value, and 25% large value. And I think over the long term, that would be a better asset allocation than simply being in the total market index.
Okay, very, Very good answer. Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much for the call. We have one caller and just about a minute and a half left. We'll have to really be quick here. Sorry about that. Mill Creek Valley, Indiana, line number one.
Yeah. You there?
Yes, yes.
Okay, hey, this will be quick, all right.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that.
I don't have enough money to invest in much of anything, but I do have a savings account. And my question is this, and maybe you can't answer it since you're more in investments. Why are our local banks, or mine at least, paying 0.35%, less than half of 1% on savings? They complain about Americans don't save money. There's no incentive. Do you have an explanation as to why savings accounts interest is so low? Thanks. I'll hang up.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Because there is great pressure on banks to be competitive in terms of an interest rate spread. And one of the ways that they can improve their interest rate spread is to pay you very, very little on a savings account. So my advice to you is to move that money within the bank. They probably have a short-term certificate of deposit or a money market account that will clearly pay higher. You should at least be earning a couple of percent, if not more. So move that savings account, unless it is a very small amount of money, like $100, $200, or $300, because then it's costing the bank paperwork simply to keep track of your investment, and that's why they would be paying such a small amount of money on that account. But otherwise, if you are in the thousands, for example, you need to sit down with that bank and move it to a higher-paying account.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there since we're out of time. Our guest has been David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. He joins us on the third Friday of each month at 10 o'clock to take your questions on personal finance, and we're always glad to have him with us. David Sinnoh, thanks so much for being here.
It was just a great deal of fun today.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week.
That's it for this hour, Focus 580. We'll take a break. When we return in just a few minutes, we'll have an archived interview with N.R. Narayanamurthy. He's the founder and chairman of Infosys Technologies in Bangalore, India, one of the leading technology firms in that country. And he was on the campus on Wednesday. We couldn't air that live, so we'll have an archive in just a few minutes. We'll take a break for some news and a market update.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. We're seeing light non-commercial short covering supporting Chicago wheat this morning. Volume relatively light in the corn pit. Also higher prices today on short.